This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Neither rain nor cold nor apparent lack of pitching prevented the St. Louis Cardinals from winning the World Series. The Cards beat the Detroit Tigers 4-2 in St. Louis last night in Game 5, hence winning the series 4-1. Joining me now to discuss the reigning champs and how they achieved that distinction is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to the program.
How are you, Bill?
Very good, thank you. Before the series began, the experts were almost unanimous in picking the Tigers to beat the Cardinals, besides the fact that none of the Detroit pitchers could dependably field their positions. How do you explain the result?
Well, first off, there was a sign in the ballpark, a very large sign that said, "The experts are idiots." So I think that explains a lot of things to begin with. What no one can explain is how, in 5 consecutive games, a Major League team can get an error from a starting pitcher. It's just a pitcher. It's amazing to me. It's the first time since 1990, when the Milwaukee Brewers did it, that we had 5 straight games where a team had an error by a pitcher. It was the strangest thing I think I've ever seen. And, you know, Jim Leland said, you know, kind of jokingly at the end, he said, "We're going to have pitcher fielding practice on the plane when we go back to Detroit." Because And not only were the errors, you know, charged to the pitchers, they were all critical errors. And, of course, it was the first time in the history of the World Series that that's ever happened, that 5 games in a row we got an error from a pitcher. And it really, really hurt the Tigers.
In the great tradition of non-heroic types rising to great heights during the series, St. Louis infielder David Eckstein was named series MVP. Good choice?
Oh, it was definitely the good choice, and it really personified what the Cardinals are all about. David Eckstein's entire story is the underdog story. And, you know, not like the listeners really know me, Bill, but I'm 5'5". David Eckstein is literally 1 inch taller than me. And the thought that a guy who's 5'6" can play on the biggest stage in the world for baseball and be the MVP and get 8 hits in the last 3 games of the series gives all little guys hope that there's, you know, someday they'll be able to do that. And, you know, Tony La Russa said repeatedly through this postseason that this is the toughest player that he's ever managed. And Tony's been managing since 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And yet yesterday, both he and Jim Leland said, "Look, we need to make this clear. This isn't just a tough little gritty guy who gets by on, you know, on guile and toughness and everything else. This is a really talented baseball player. And I hope the world knows now that this guy can really play. He's not just a little guy. He's a little guy with a lot of talent."
This was a series that featured 2 of baseball's more highly regarded managers, La Russa and Leland. To what extent did Tony La Russa outmanage his counterpart?
Well, he did outmanage Jim Leland, but it's not that Jim Leland did anything wrong. It's just that everything Tony La Russa did turned out perfectly. And that's not just in the World Series, Bill. I covered the series before the League Championship Series against the Mets, and everything Tony La Russa did turned out. Now, sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But every button he pushed, every lineup change he made, every pitcher he brought in, every time he put the steel on or the bunt or anything else, it always worked. And that's what happens when, you know, you've managed over 100 playoff games in your career, as La Russa has. It's what happens when, you know, you're a Hall of Fame manager, which he is, because now he and Sparky Anderson are the only 2 managers ever to win the World Series managing in both leagues.
The St. Louis pitching staff was supposed to have been exhausted because they had to throw a lot more innings to get to the World Series than the Tigers staff did. Was Cardinal pitching exceptionally good, or was Detroit hitting just uncharacteristically inept?
Well, it was a little of both, certainly. But what happened was the whole series changed for me in Game 1 when Anthony Reyes, who is just a rookie and really has no business starting Game 1 of the World Series, since he had the fewest wins ever by a Game 1 starter in the World Series 5, he went out and pitched a gem, and that changed the entire series. He goes into Detroit and beats, you know, a quality starter for the Tigers when nobody saw that coming. And it was an omen for the Tigers that you guys are really up against it. And the Cardinals pitched like crazy the rest of the series. And it was a rookie that got him going. And before you know it, it was Chris Carpenter pitching one of the greatest games in World Series history that I could see. And, you know, even in the last game, Jeff Weaver, reclamation project, 3-10 record when the Cardinals acquired him from the Angels because the Angels just wanted to get rid of him, pitches the game of his life in Game 5 and ends up winning them the World Series.
Would you agree with me that one lesson we should take from this series is that even the best major league hitters can and will be fooled by a great curveball, at least when it's thrown by Adam Wainwright, except when he closes the final game with a slider?
Adam Wainwright is, again, another story of the Cardinals that really depicts where they came from this year. He's the saying last night that he just wanted to make the team this year, and ultimately he did, but he was the third closer that they used this season. Their number one guy, Jason Isringhausen, got hurt, then Braden Looper, the second guy, failed, and in the end they had to go to him in the postseason because they basically didn't have anyone else, and not only was he good, he was great, and he became the second rookie pitcher ever to save the clinching game of the World Series. And for that kid to come out of nowhere and throw that 12-6, as we call it, curveball, the one that drops right off a table, and do it so consistently in the postseason, he's one of those really good stories on the Cardinals that makes you wonder, you know, weren't they destined to win after all? Because this kid wasn't even supposed to be on the team, let alone be the closer, closes, you know, the biggest game of the year.
Tim Kirkjian of ESPN and ESPN the Magazine speaking to me from the hotel room, which he will happily bid goodbye very shortly so he can go home. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you very much, Bill.
This week, the Professional Bowlers Association Tour kicked off the season with one of its biggest events, the USBC Masters, currently ongoing at Wauwatosa, Wisconsin's Bowlero Lanes. This year, the men of the PBA Tour will have to contend with Kelly Kulick, who in June became the first female to earn an exemption through the PBA's qualifying trials. Only a Game's Greg Eklund is in Wauwatosa and has more on the woman who would become queen of the kingpins.
Good luck to everybody and enjoy.
Here we go. All right, guys, let's go.
Kelly Kulick is thrilled about the recent wave of bowling publicity. The day before this week's USBC Masters tournament began, her story made page one of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, above the fold. In the headline, she saw the word that has become synonymous with her accomplishment.
Pioneer. Yes, trendsetter, pioneer. You know, it'll never be as big as Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. You know, again, it is huge, and I think people really don't understand what it really means to myself, women bowlers, male bowlers, the industry of bowling itself. A full season of qualification on the tour. I haven't comprehended it. I don't think people truly understand it.
It's tempting to portray Kulick as the Michelle Wee or Danica Patrick of bowling, but she points out one distinct difference between her and Wee. Kulick earned her exemption without the megabucks of a sponsor.
I think what she's doing is great. I've told a lot of people, I said she's just bettering herself as an athlete. Mm-hmm. Playing against the men, she hasn't made a cut, but eventually she's going to learn and get better, and she will make a cut. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I earned my way, and I wasn't given a silver spoon. There was no commissioner's exemption that I've received in the past. I did it all on my own with the help of a few people along the way, and was successful.
Yeah. What's the lake did you fish at? Were they catfish, whitefish?
From rock to rock to find a nibble. I finally found the right rock.
Though Kulick says she has felt welcomed by the men of the PBA Tour, opinions have differed on how she'll fare. Walter Ray Williams, the PBA's all-time leader in victories with 42, admitted he was somewhat surprised Kulick captured an exemption.
We've had tournaments together with the women, and it's not that the women can't bowl well, because they can, but overall, for a long period of time, I think there's about a 10-pin a game difference, and that's a pretty good difference.
Along with Kulick, Del Ballard Jr. endured the qualifying process last June despite having won 12 PBA titles, making him one of only 10 exempt bowlers with double-digit career victories. While he nailed down the final exemption spot for this season, he marveled at Kulick's ability to withstand the pressure.
She has a good mental game. She had a couple opportunities during the tour trials there to kind of pack it in and kind of lose focus, and she didn't. She stayed with what she was doing, bowled a 300 game the last round, and secured a spot.
Ballard Jr. says he has heard that not everyone is ready to welcome Kulick to the lanes.
It's way behind the scenes. I had heard that there were a few emails sent, you know, complaining that the women shouldn't be allowed to bowl. It makes us look bad. These are the people that can't beat them anyway. And they're going to complain about anything, no matter what it is. And they just need to face it. Hey, look, you know what? Women are allowed to bowl our tour. Get ready for it. I mean, there's a lot more than just one or two that can bowl.
And the women have no alternative but to bowl against the men. The women's tour folded 3 years ago at a time when Kulik started to emerge as one of the top female professional bowlers. Kulik pondered her future in bowling as she helped her father at the body shop he owns in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
I was questioning it. Is it going to come back? Is it not going to come back? What should I do? I was financially secure enough that I could keep bowling for the last few years and see where it's going to lead if I made the men's tour. But I was devastated when it folded.
Do you need back for this, sir?
Please.
Kulik's presence on the tour this year has made an impact on the PBA's merchandising, according to the PBA's merchandise director, Curtis Von Kruger.
Most definitely. We actually even have our signature Kelly Kulik hat. We're starting to develop a woman's type bowling stuff. As you can see, we have pinks are starting to come out, stuff that you haven't seen in bowling in the past.
Eight-year tour veteran Chris Barnes, who capped last season with a title in the Tournament of Champions, believed before Kulik broke through that a female would eventually qualify for the tour. In his words, the pins don't know gender. If Kulik is successful on the PBA Tour, Barnes believes it would create widespread appeal for the sport.
All the pieces have to fall together at the right time with the right environment around, too. And we have an environment that allows for change and allows for women to compete on a men's tour and to be accepted that way, both inside the tour and from the public. And if she bowls well enough, she'll certainly make some waves in a way that haven't ever been made in men's professional bowling.
But Kulik has more in mind than pink hats, publicity, and making waves.
To me, it's really about the bowling and the titles. The money is good, and everybody needs to survive, and I want the money. But from it is the prestige of the title.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
Kelly Kulik made it to the field of 64 this week, but was eliminated from the USBC Masters in match play on Thursday. The tournament finals take place tomorrow at the Wisconsin Expo Center. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the man watching doesn't turn out to be a couch potato. But first, two games today and two more tomorrow will determine which four teams move into the semifinals of Major League Soccer's postseason. Joining me now to discuss same is Grant Wall, who covers soccer for Sports Illustrated. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be back.
D.C. United had the best record during the regular season despite a slump toward the end. After they beat the New York Red Bulls in Game 1 of their Eastern Conference semifinal on Saturday, Bulls midfielder Demi Kovalenko said, "They're not that good." Will that provide all the motivation United needs to prevail tomorrow?
It just might. Not that they really need it, because they've been playing poorly all through the last few weeks, and I think they're really up for a big performance, and I think they might get that, actually, against a Red Bulls team that really isn't that good and is probably overachieved just to get to the playoffs.
Red Bulls coach Bruce Arena, speaking of the goal Cristian Gomez scored on a pass from Jaime Moreno, said, "They're the only two players in the league that can pull that off." Was he baiting his own offense?
I think in a way he was just speaking the truth. When you look at D.C. United and the guys they have up front in Gomez and Moreno, and Freddie Adu for that matter, it's one of the best combinations this league has seen. Gomez is going to be the MVP of this league. He's been a great addition since coming in from Argentina 2 years ago. And if you're Bruce Arena and you're coaching the Red Bull, the team that's had trouble scoring all year, you probably wish you had those guys on your side.
In the other Eastern Conference matchup, the New England Revolution will welcome the Chicago Fire to perhaps the most beat-up field in the league. Does that constitute an advantage for the Revolution?
I don't think it constitutes an advantage for anybody. I really wish the Kraft would get together their groundskeeping crew and get things ready for a playoff game like this. It's not really showing a lot of respect for the sport. And the fact is that the Revs need as many goals as they can to get back in this series and win it, and they need a good field to do that.
Revolution midfielder Shaury Joseph will not play in tonight's game. He was suspended by the league following the first game for an errant elbow, even though he was not tossed out of that game while it was going on. Was that a legitimate move by MLS?
I've got a real problem with this call, because Joseph didn't even get a card a yellow card for it, even though the referee was standing right next to him. It's an awfully drastic measure to take considering what happened on the field, where Ivan Guerrero from Chicago just climbed onto Joseph's back, and Joseph was trying to get rid of him. And yes, he did use his elbow to do that, but I don't think it was malicious in any way. This is the third time this year that the Revolution has had a post facto game suspension like this, and they're not the only team that's been impacted by it this year, but they've been affected more than anyone else has. And for a game of this magnitude, everything in MLS rides on the playoffs. It's almost like the regular season doesn't matter, given how many teams make the playoffs. And for this kind of a draconian move to take place strikes me as just way too much.
In the West, the Colorado Rapids outshot FC Dallas 17-6 and lost in that first game. Does Coach Fernando Clavijo tell his Rapids to shoot less often tonight?
Just shoot straighter, you know? It's the kind of thing where the Rapids surprisingly put out a lot of offense in that first game. And they're a team that I don't think is that particularly good, but they've got a chance going back to Dallas. They upset Dallas last year in the playoffs, too. I think there's a possibility they can make a game of it in the return.
In the other Western Conference matchup, the Houston Dynamo will try to come back having lost Game 1 of their series to Chivas USA 2-1. Chivas keeper Brad Guzan saved a penalty kick in that game. How big a boost does that give a team?
Well, it's a huge boost when you look at they've got a one-goal advantage they're taking back to Houston now, and it would have been totally tied up and would have been really difficult, I think, for Chivas to seal the deal back on a visiting field like that. So we'll see how things shake out. But Brad Guzan has really fought this year. He's a guy who lost his job earlier in the season and then regained it and made probably the biggest play of the entire first weekend of the playoffs by that save last weekend.
We're not past round one of these playoffs yet, Grant, but live dangerously. Tell me which teams will meet in the final on November 12th and which of those two prevails.
Well, I put my picks out there every year, and some years I'm dead on and some not so much. this year I picked one upset in the first round. I picked Chivas to upset Houston in their series. And then in the Eastern Conference, I actually have New England upsetting D.C. In D.C. to get to the final and have them meeting Chivas in the final in Dallas. I think Chivas is going to actually beat Dallas in the Western Conference final. And then it's really anybody's game in that final in Dallas, but I like New England. I picked them to win it. I think Clint Dempsey is, when he's on, there's no better player in this league. And I think he's probably in his last games with the league before getting sold to a team in England in January.
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated. Grant, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Since there has been a national championship for college soccer teams comprised of women, the team from the University of North Carolina has won 17 titles. That has left 6 titles for the rest of the teams to take home, and 3 times those teams have had to beat North Carolina in the final. The constant through the 23 years of UNC's exceptional run has been Coach Anson Dorrance, about whom Tim Cruthers has written a book titled The Man Watching. Tim Cruthers joins me now from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Tim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate you having me on.
And at Tim's side in the studio is Anson Dorrance himself. Anson, welcome back to the program.
Bill, my pleasure.
Anson, UNC began the current season 0-1. What the heck is wrong down there?
Yeah, we were seeing these cracks appear in the foundation, and, you know, the world was ending. And to be honest, we were down at Texas A&M, and they had this monstrous crowd. In fact, I think it broke the regular season record for NCAA women's soccer attendance. They did a super job. Their team was outstanding. They took us out honorably, so we have no regrets, and we tried to put the pieces back together. And so we deserve to lose that game.
Bruce Arena, The notoriously prickly former coach of the U.S. men's national team is quoted in The Man Watching as saying, "I thought I was the most arrogant person in the world until I met Anson Dorrance." Anson, were you flattered or insulted by that?
Oh, listen, I like Bruce Arena. He and I are great friends. He can get away with that quote anytime he likes. And it's tongue-in-cheek. I mean, he's a good friend of mine. That is certainly not derogatory. It's just Bruce's sense of humor. And, I mean, that's water off a duck's back coming from Bruce for me. I have huge respect for him as a man and as a coach. So we've been rivals as ACC men's coaches for years. And that was tongue-in-cheek. And so that's the way I look at it. And absolutely no insult felt on my part from who I think is a remarkable American coach.
Tim, you write at one point that in Anson's case, it's hard to distinguish arrogance from innocence. What did you mean by that?
Well, Anson has an interesting and very different and unique personality. A lot of the things that he does that the people outside of UNC, the people that he likes to term the dark side, tend to think that a lot of the things that he does come off to them as arrogant when... In Anson's case, he's just going about his business. He doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't see it as arrogant. There are, I think, examples of just, you know, times when he has said things to maybe a particular official in a game that he's sort of saying them for comic effect and maybe to amuse himself and amuse the players on the bench, keep everybody loose. But that an opposing coach hearing those same things said to the referee might... term it as arrogant. I think there's just a general feeling, obviously, naturally, a bit of a professional jealousy amongst some of his coaching opponents. You naturally, I think, would take things that might be pretty innocent to most people as a negative in his case.
Many of your former players at UNC and on the national team are quoted in the book expressing their gratitude for how you helped them realize their competitive potential and various other things beyond soccer as well, but the verdict is not quite unanimous. Tiffany Milbritt, one of the most accomplished strikers ever to play the game, calls you, quote, "the most evil person I've ever known." Were you surprised by that?
No. I wasn't. There's always a tension in a coaching dynamic between an underachieving player and her potential. A part of your challenging coaching is to take a kid that has just remarkable potential like a Tiffany Milbritt and to get her where you think she can go as an athlete. And I had her early in her career, so I had her as this embryo, huge talent. And I really felt like she could be a significant player on the world scene. And when you're given this kind of talent, I think one of your obligations in coaching is to try to get her there. The ride is not a comfortable one. I mean, basically, this isn't good enough. That's not good enough. This isn't good enough. You're not trying hard enough. There's not enough discipline. There's this. There's that. And I think just the tension of that dynamic made it difficult for her. You know, I certainly don't hold any of her opinions against her. And actually, she ultimately did achieve her potential. She became a remarkable striker on the world stage. But there's a progression to get there. And oftentimes, it's not a comfortable one. Back when I was training her, I thought she was an underachiever. And I was doing everything I could to try to get her to where I thought she could go.
In 1998, you were accused of harassment by a former player, Debbie Keller, and that suit dragged on for years before it was resolved. The university paid Ms. Keller a settlement in 2003. She acknowledged that your harassment consisted of comments that you'd made during conversation with her and with other players. Your style of coaching has included sarcasm and also sometimes players leaving the field in tears. There have also been personal letters to players. Did Debbie Keller's suit change the way you coach?
No. In fact, one of the wonderful aspects of this lawsuit was the community sort of gathering around what we were doing. And one thing that was really neat is Michael Hooker's wife, Carmen. Michael was our chancellor at the time, and the Hookers were huge fans of the women's team. And embraced us and came with us on a lot of our road trips, sat with us on the bench, and just huge supporters of the program, came to practice And one thing Carmen did, which I thought was very powerful, she came to practice shortly after the lawsuit basically came out and told us not to change. She'd seen our culture and had seen how positive everybody was within the culture and how enjoyable the whole thing was. And she instructed basically the girls on this new, I guess, defense, this sexual harassment law that was available to them. And not to wield it as a weapon because you didn't like the way someone treated you, and not to sort of use this as your weapon because it's an unfair retaliation for, you know, whatever gripe you might have. And what I really appreciated about her is she saw us, saw our culture, but also knew that, you know, as we're exploring new laws like this one, they can be wielded improperly. And she wanted all the young women in the program to understand that this is not a weapon you should select to use lightly.
Tim, I'm curious about the extent to which the women's soccer program at UNC is a cult of personality. How good will that team be when Anson Dorrance is no longer the guy calling to recruit the best high school soccer players in the country?
That's a great question. I do think that part of what UNC and Anson have tried to develop is just what you're talking about. There's a toughness, there's a grit, there's just a grinding nature that Anson tries to build into the program that I think a lot of people assume that the success is based purely on talent and the bringing in the best players and just letting them sort of take over the game. And the fact is that a soccer game is much different than a basketball game or a football game. It's based on a lot of times one team just outgrinding and outworking each other because it's so tremendously hard to score. And I think that's what makes the game so distinct from so many other sports. So I think what Anson would hope for is that he's created a culture that would be carried on perhaps by somebody else who had played at Carolina, if that was the next coach, which mm-hmm. seems likely to me, and that they could continue that based on the fact that he has bred into them this culture that he would hope, I think, would carry on beyond him. Because it's been bred into whoever might succeed him down the road.
Looking ahead just a little bit, Anson, I guess given the loss to Texas A&M, the 0-1 record to start the season, I guess UNC goes into next month's national tournament as an underdog.
Yeah, let's keep pushing that. There's no better motivational platform than everyone thinks you're abominable. So, yeah, we'll milk that for all it's worth. So trust me, we would love to go in as an underdog. And I think we have an opportunity to do that. That's a wonderful platform to motivate your players from. In fact, do you mind just coming by and giving that rap to the players before the tournament?
Anson Dorrance has led his UNC team to 17 national championships. He joined me from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Anson, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Hey, I had a good time. Thank you, Bill.
Tim Cruthers is the author of The Man Watching, a biography of Anson Dorrance, the unlikely architect of the greatest college sports dynasty ever. Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Daisy, Daisy, have you ever seen so many movies involving bicycles? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news, preceded by a discussion of his new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
What led you to decide Tom Brady, who told you that he wasn't sure he was old enough to be the subject of a book, would in fact be worthy of that effort?
Because he told me he wasn't old enough and didn't give me a bogus football player's two-minute blow-off answer. He gave me an answer with some thought and some depth to it. And I said, well, you know, if you think you've turned this project off, boy, you have another thing coming. I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this particular book at this particular time was the fact that he is always credited with having all the quote-unquote intangibles. One of the problems with writing about intangibles is that they're not tangible. So I wanted to see if I could find a source for the stuff that you can't measure with a stopwatch and the stuff that you can't time and can't see on the game film. So I went after it in that angle. Then I tried to get into what all this has brought him in his attempts to maintain a normal life.
Well, the biography is full of intriguing propositions, among them the contention that Brady has been more successful than many stars at holding on to the identity that he had built before he became a superstar. How has he managed that?
I think part of it is that superstardom came to him when he was prepared to accept it. Being recruited from high school, he had not been the first option, far from the first option, at the University of Michigan. He was a sixth-round draft pick who regardless of whether or not it might have happened eventually anyway, got the job with the New England Patriots only because the person playing in front of him took a frightful hit and was out for the year. So I think that while he was maintaining this kind of steady upward career path, he also was locking himself into a public identity of being a teammate.
In one of my favorite moments in the book, Brady, as a rookie, introduces himself to Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, by saying, quote, "We haven't met yet, but I'm the best decision this franchise has ever made." No lack of confidence
No.
in this lad Brady, is there?
No, and this was when he was a scout team quarterback, and Bob Kraft tells the story of meeting him as Brady was walking out of the stadium in jeans and a T-shirt carrying a pizza. In his case, do not mistake modesty and mildness for humility, because there is an athlete's ego in there that comes out not at surprising times, but at very important times.
You write of how at the end of the 05 season, Tom Brady thanked you for being around. That was what he said, and for writing the book, I assume. Have you any sense of what he thinks of the final product?
No, I do not yet, because the book doesn't have to stand still next Wednesday, and we shall see what we shall see. It's interesting. I've never written a book specifically about a living person before, so it's an interesting dynamic.
Not only a living person, but a person whose career may be, what, a third over?
That's the other point of this. If he runs off and joins the Franciscans tomorrow, he's already in the Football Hall Fame. And the book is also about what if the second chapter of your career has already started.
Moving on to various other sports-related matters. Behind the scenes of the 2006 World Series, baseball's owners and players have agreed to a new five-year deal. No lockout, no strike. Pretty dull, huh?
And it happened all at once and out of nowhere. I didn't even know they were negotiating.
Me neither.
But the agreement will run through 2011. There's some tinkering with the agreement. It doesn't alter the drug testing policy, which has caused a few yahoos to start screaming about what do they want and when are they going to do this and blah, 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 blah. The money is going up. Labor peace has been achieved through 2011. In baseball terms, this is good.
The Buffalo Sabres are 10-0, good enough to tie the best start in National Hockey League history, and all it took was a little old lockout year before last.
Yeah, they rebuilt themselves the way the Boston Bruins, for example, convinced their fans they were redoing it. I'm a little surprised that 10-0 is the best start in NHL history.
I was, too.
I thought one of those Canadian teams might have ripped off 12 or 14 in a row
or to start. Or gone without a loss the whole season, the way we hear about Rocket Richard. Tough times for the Bruins, by the way, speaking of them, over at the New Garden the other night.
Yeah, it would be unkind for me to say that the game against the Canadiens resulted in even more garbage being thrown across the ice in Boston. They had a tight game with the Canadiens. Andre Markov beat them with 1.2 seconds left, and there was all kinds of stuff thrown out of the stands.
the Bruins fans, what Bruins fans there are at this point, an incredibly bad start. 2-5-1 after this Montreal game in a year they were supposed to have been rebuilt the way Buffalo did. Fans threw things on the ice. It got ugly. The referees called the game before time had expired. A real black eye if anyone was paying attention, but luckily very few people were.
In NFL action, Drew Bledsoe, the man who lost his job several years ago to the aforementioned Tom Brady, lost another job this week. Good decision by Dallas coach Bill Parcells.
Weird decision by Dallas coach Bill Parcells. For the first time, he looked like he had somebody looking over his shoulder. The decision to pull Drew Bledsoe in the middle of the game against the Giants really looked like the word had come down from Jerry Jones on high, and I've just never seen Bill Parcells act as precipitously as he did. Drew Bledsoe was having a sort of bad Drew Bledsoe game, but Tony Romo came in and was infinitely worse.
We have a new record for a cable TV audience. I was not surprised that the record was set during a Monday night football game. I was a bit surprised at the programming that had set the previous record.
Yeah, this has been one of the longest standing weird records in all of the media. The previous record holder was the November 1993 debate over the North American Free Trade Agreement between Al Gore and Ross Perot on Larry King Live! Bob and Pacoima, you've been outsourced. Next. Anyway, it has been now exceeded by the Giants-Cowboys game last week. 11 million, almost 12 million homes. And the record, of course, it stood for nearly 13 years. And I think the only time anybody would refer to that record would be as, can you believe that's the biggest thing in the history of cable?
The National Basketball Association season begins Tuesday. To which NBA teams will you pay close attention during the interminable 2006-2007 season?
Well, your defending champion Miami Heat were 2-5 in the exhibition season, so who the heck knows what they're going to be like. Toronto was undefeated. I'm fairly sure they won't stay there. The intriguing one is Ben Wallace moving to the Chicago Bulls, who were really only about one step away from contending for at least to get to the NBA Finals. He will give them some toughness. He will give them as much rebounding as he has left in his legs. I think they're a fascinating team to watch.
Commissioner Stern is becoming more and more, well, Stern. He said this week that he didn't think NBA players should carry guns. Reasonable request?
Not necessarily. He says they shouldn't carry guns when they go out on the town, which is probably a smart idea, because while nothing good can happen at a strip joint at 3 o'clock in the morning, something really bad always happens at a strip joint at 3 o'clock in the morning if you're packing.
Should the commissioner's suggestion extend to, parents of 5- and 6-year-old football players?
What is going on in Philadelphia? In Northeast Philadelphia, they're playing a 5- and 6-year-old little guys conference peewee football game. A parent gets into a wrangle with a coach over playing time. They swing at each other. People start screaming, fight, fight, like they're all in sixth grade. And then daddy pulls out a gun.
From his waistband. It's in plain sight.
He came ready to emphasize his arguments on behalf of his 5-year-old child with a .357 Magnum.
Charlie, you know all those soccer players who kept falling down and clutching their knees during the World Cup tournament?
I was worried about them because some of them looked like they were really seriously injured.
Well, it turns out a lot of them weren't really
hurt.
Can you believe that?
That's hard to believe. Really? Professor Yuri Dvorak, who's FIFA's world chief medical officer, as showed a, quote, cheating culture at the highest level of the game.
Shock, shock.
The problem with this bill, as we have discussed before, is there's no rule you can pass unless you just declare open season, eliminate cards, and let them beat the hell out of each other, which, while it will get you a bigger American audience, probably won't go over too well in the rest of the world.
And finally, Charlie, Tuesday is Halloween, and my understanding is that if you like, you can join a former NBA star to celebrate the occasion. Am I right that the opportunity is, in fact, still available?
Yes, nobody is bidding so far on the chance to spend Halloween with Dennis Rodman, which is, of course,
In Las Vegas,
which is piling redundancy upon redundancy so high you may never see home again.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He's the author of Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, available in bookstores, probably even as we speak. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm casting my spell on you. You'll never, never be untrue. 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 You'll never.
The cycling community comes together for all kinds of events, group rides, fundraisers, political statements, tours to fill in the blank, and the like. Last week, Michelle Seaton pedaled to a Boston-area landmark to witness a new venue for those with passion for the bicycle, and she has our report.
In a darkened movie theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, dozens of biking enthusiasts watch a film about their favorite subject, bicycles.
I love going fast. You know, I want to go faster and faster.
On screen, a young girl pedals furiously while being chased down the highway by a state trooper.
Was I speeding?
Yes, you were.
How fast was I going?
253 and a 45.
That's all?
The thing is, I'm going to have to give you a ticket.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
I'm going to need some information.
This movie, called POV Me, is about a young cyclist who races on a bicycle designed to go faster than 50 miles per hour. This screening is one of 13 bike-related films shown over two nights at the second annual Boston Bike Film Festival. According to executive director Kat Bryant, the festival gives a forum to avid cyclists who are also amateur filmmakers.
I have a film about a photographer who photographs a lot of bikes. I have a film about a woman who did a trek from Route 66, the old Route 66 from California to Chicago. I have a film about, it's actually a preview of a documentary about a woman who rode all around the world in 1894, left her husband and kids, and did this crazy ride all around the world.
Another film, called Criminal Mass, details one writer's adventures in New York City's criminal justice system after being arrested while biking in the city. Filmmaker Chris Ryan kept his camera running during his arrest.
Somebody, this is an illegal arrest! I didn't do anything wrong!
Ryan was riding as part of a group called Critical Mass, a group of cyclists that tours the streets of Manhattan once a month to promote bike commuting. Lately, they've been getting arrested a lot. Some films are only tangentially related to biking.
Hi, my name's Rob Fine, and now I live in Quincy, Mass. And in the process of selling bikes, I was taking a lot of photos of bikes.
The End of Hydrocarbon Man is a movie about a guy who takes photographs of bikes. Still, it contains some pretty pointed observations about the evils of a gas-fueled commute.
But in the meantime, we're all driving around in cars, spewing fumes, paying good cash money, American money, to these countries who actually support terrorism. And so really, when you think of it, gas is the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. We kill ourselves with it every day.
Several audience members nod enthusiastically. One or two even cheer each pot shot at cars and traffic jams, which suggests that road rage extends to idle cyclists as well. Lauren Heffron runs a bike touring company and has come to the festival to share in this group celebration of bike-related filmmaking. She admits that cyclists do harbor some resentment toward cars.
It's inevitable because if you do try to bicycle, it is often a challenge that really you do feel like you're up against cars. And people don't realize that you are traffic too. I think that people that do bicycle often feel very adamant about trying to either promote it in their own way or trying to just get out there and role model or be political.
Not all of the films are overtly political. Filmmaker and cyclist Lynette Chang has submitted a 45-minute film called Route 66, Cycling the Mother Road, about her 2,000-mile tour from California to Chicago. Chang claims to be the least professional filmmaker in the group because she shoots her films using a pocket camera.
I use a digital camera, and I just use a 12-inch laptop with iMovie, iDVD, you know, the kind of the cheap software, and I put it all together because I'm a big proponent out of getting everything you can out of all you got, you know. So I work for.
Wait, you use a digital camera, like
a
still camera?
I'm going to show you a digital still camera. Here it is. That's the.
And you shoot entire movies.
Yes.
On
yes, you can. Of course, you can. Of course, it's not quite as slick and smooth as a big camera, but you see with this thing, you stick it in people's faces and you talk, and they don't think you're taking a video, so they don't freeze up, so you get spontaneity, which I think is really important.
Last year, Chang submitted a film about her bike trek up a mountain in Peru. It was called 16,000 Feet on a Friday, and it won the Audience Favorite Award at last year's film festival, despite the jump cuts and windblown audio. Chang herself was mystified by the award.
I don't know what they like about it. Maybe they like the theme. It's because it's all, well, for me, it's all about content. You have good content, then they'll forgive all the jaggy bits when it's not quite smooth.
Like many of the people at this festival, Chang is an avid bike commuter. In fact, she gave up driving entirely 15 years ago and now travels the country exclusively on her bike. But a few attendees at the Boston Bike Film Festival are new to biking culture. Deirdre Carrasco-Smith has wanted to learn to ride her whole life. Just last week, she signed up for a special class that teaches adults to ride a bike.
It was just like a wish, just like a little wish that was buried way down. And I forgot about it for years and years until I saw the little ad, if you've never ridden a bike, then this is the class for you. And my heart said, and the dream just came back from 50 years ago. Yeah, that's what happened.
Smith has come to the Bike Film Festival with her riding instructor, Susan McLucas, because now that she can ride a bike, she's developed a passion for every aspect of cycling. She can't explain it.
Unless you yourself have been afraid to get on the bike, you wouldn't imagine what it is to even be able to sit on it, to push something with your own body, something that you've been so afraid of. It's maybe I'll never get on the street, it doesn't matter. If something happened and I couldn't get to the class, I'm no longer afraid to be on a bike.
Smith's newfound passion may be inexplicable to her, but not to anyone at the Boston Bike Film Festival, including bike commuter Jack Johnson.
Yeah, I like to watch films about bicycling. It's a rainy night. You know, it's great to be out here looking at movies for bikes. It's a cultural event, and I think it's a way for a lot of, you know, the hardcore cycling community to come together and socialize a little bit before, which is what we're doing right now. So, yeah, it's fun to see everybody out.
Just one look around the room confirms that the cycling community has come out in force. Here, everyone is carrying a helmet. Nearly everyone has a backpack stocked with a rain poncho, extra gloves, and a bike pump. Here, all cyclists are welcome. For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Elias Feldman. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about The Man Watching, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Sports Illustrated soccer scribe Grant Wall, who comments as New England Revolution donuts arrive in the Only a Game studios.
Well, it's like maybe it was donuts being in the shape of their goal total from last weekend.
I get the reference to zero, as in nil, but what's signified by the frosting and those red, white, and blue sprinkles? Tastes like victory. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org.